All right. I was planning on starting with some of these oldies but goodies for the next few, 10, 15 minutes. And if you have any requests, feel free to shout them out, and we can watch them together. And after each one, we can do a little Q&A. If you have any questions, raise your hand. What was that? Freebird? I have my Freebird. I'm saving it for the right moment. All right, so how about this one? This is the first one. This is the one that started it all. Brother Jake explains the gospel. So without further ado, here we go.
Hi, I'm Brother Jake. And in response to all these so-called intellectuals coming to church and talking about how complicated the gospel is, I wanted to set the record straight. If there was one word I'd use to describe the gospel, I think it would be simple. Let me explain. You see, it all has to do with God's plan for us. Before we were born, we lived with God, and he had this idea that we should come live here and be tested so we could become like him. So we all came down to earth to follow the gospel of Christ and become members of his one true church that was restored on the earth.
Wait, I should probably back up and explain a couple things really quick. Because since the whole point of life was to avoid Satan's temptations and follow God's commandments so we can be happy, people needed some way to learn about them. So God would call these dudes as prophets, starting with Adam and going to Abraham and Moses and Joshua and all those other guys, and tell them what was up and give them the priesthood, which was like the authority of God. But every once in a while, the people would reject the prophets and kill them, so then the priesthood would be lost and nobody could be saved. When that happens, it's called an apostasy. And for things to get back on track, God would have to go find some other dude and say, hey, we need a prophet, and here's the priesthood, so get out there and spread the word. And when that happens, it's called a restoration. So Christ came as the Son of God to restore the word of God after an apostasy, but he also taught that everyone should turn the other cheek, and instead of doing stuff like sacrificing animals, they needed to get baptized and get the Holy Spirit to be saved. When people started to do that, they became members of his church, which he set up by calling these 12 guys that followed him around as apostles and giving them the priesthood so they could give people legit baptisms and stuff. Then Jesus did something called the atonement, where he suffered in the Garden of Gethsemane and on the cross for all the bad things anyone will ever do, and all the bad things that will ever happen to anyone. Then, 3 days after he died, he came back to life and went back to heaven. Now, the apostles were supposed to keep the church running so that people could hear about Jesus and get real baptisms by the real priesthood, but people killed them all, and the true gospel and the priesthood got lost. That's called the Great Apostasy. Fast forward to 1820. There was a 14-year-old named Joseph Smith who wanted to know which church was true. So he prayed to God, and God and Jesus appeared to him and said that none of them were true and called him to be the prophet to restore the true church again. And through Joseph Smith, God revealed all sorts of cool stuff, like the Book of Mormon, which is the ancient writings of some people that lived in 600 BC and sailed to America from Jerusalem and lived here for thousands of years before all the good ones died, and someone buried the metal book with their history written on it in a hill behind where Joseph Smith would live 700 years later when he translated their writing by the power of God. And that's how you can know that Joseph Smith was a real prophet, and this is the one true church of Christ. Joseph also got the priesthood back from angels that came down and gave it to him so he could put back the church the way it was when Jesus was alive, with like 12 apostles and stuff. And the restoration of the priesthood meant that people could really start living the true gospel of Christ again, which has some steps. First, you gotta believe in Jesus. Then you gotta repent of all the bad things you do. That doesn't necessarily mean that you're gonna stop doing anything bad because, nobody's perfect, but you gotta try. Then you gotta get baptized, but not just by anybody. You have to be baptized by a bona fide priesthood holder because otherwise it won't count. It would be like if an ice cream truck pulled you over and gave you a speeding ticket. Would you pay that ticket? No way, because it's a freaking ice cream truck. They got no authority. Same thing with getting baptized. Same thing with getting the gift of the Holy Ghost. They have to be done by somebody with the real priesthood. That's why it's important to be in the true restored church. But even after that, you still have to keep living a good life. Being nice and charitable and paying your tithing and only having heterosexual sex with the person you're married to after you're married and going to church for 3 hours every Sunday and serving in the lay clergy and reading your scriptures every day and praying every day and having family home evening and not drinking coffee or tea or alcohol or using tobacco or drugs. What else? Oh, I almost forgot. The temple. The temples are these super sacred places where you can only get in if you follow God's rules and are part of the true church. Now, in the temple, you can get married so that your family stays together after you die. Also, in the temple, you can do stuff like get baptized for people that are dead, so people have a chance to be saved even if they didn't get to hear about the true church while they were alive, which is pretty great because otherwise all the people who lived between the Great Apostasy and Joseph Smith would be pretty much screwed. Anyway, thanks to the gospel, which is all those steps I talked about before, and the atonement of Christ, we can be cleansed from sin and get into heaven. One quick note about heaven, turns out there are three levels. Top level is called the celestial kingdom, and that's where we can go and be with our families and be just like God. Then there's the terrestrial kingdom, where you go if you were good, but you didn't get baptized in the true church and go to the temple and all that. It's pretty good, but you don't get to go with your family and do cool God stuff. Then there's the telestial kingdom, where all the bums and partiers go. Oh, if you're like really, really bad, you can go to outer darkness with Satan, but that's pretty rare. So that's the gospel. Come here, learn about Christ's gospel, believe in Jesus, learn about the restored true church, get baptized, get the gift of the Holy Ghost, go to the temple, get married, do all the other stuff there, live by God's rules for the rest of your life, and you get into super VIP heaven. See? Simple.
you very much. Any requests for the next video or questions? There's Book of Mormon translation, Meant Symbolically, which is the musical one. My favorite? Ooh, that's hard. I mean, usually my favorite is the one that I just made, in most cases. So, like, in this case, it's the one that I haven't told you about yet. Or the Branches of Mormonism. That was a very interesting one, because I had a kind of interesting experience recently. So my friend that we met, when we lived in Indiana, we had this friend, and he has a teenage daughter, and we were sitting there talking about One Direction, as I usually do. Most of my time is used talking about One Direction. And we were talking, oh, well, yeah, it's a boy band. But she was insistent, no, they're unique, they're special. It's a very unique and special approach. And keep in mind, I'd never seen One Direction. I didn't know anything about them. I kind of knew that they were somewhere, you know, in the ether, but I didn't know, like, really who they were. I said, oh, hold on a second. Let me guess. They have between 3 and 5 members. They sing about how they'll never break your heart. One of them's kind of the dark, one of them has like dark hair and he's like a little bit taller and he's kind of the bad boy and everybody. And then there's one that's like a really good, as I'm describing this band that I've never seen before, her jaw just dropped and she looked horrified. But I realized that it was the same, I had a similar experience when I started investigating some of the other branches of the Mormon movement, where even when I left Mormonism, I was like, well, at least I have this very special, unique experience. I was a Mormon. No one else, you know, it's just a special, one of a kind. There's nothing like the church that I grew up in. There was like the kind of the special elitism that I kept with me. But then as I started learning more about the other branches of the Mormon movement that differed in very, you know, specific but, you know, kind of minor ways or interesting ways, I realized that LDS Mormonism was my One Direction. And I like thought, this is this special thing that I have, but, you know, it's just one of many branches of the Mormon movement. It just happens to be the largest one, and the one that I grew up in. So that one was a lot of fun. Sorry, that was a long-winded answer, but I know a big hit usually is the Mormons Are Not Sexist. Any interest in hearing that one? All right. Let's give that one a try. Here we go.
Hi, I'm Brother Jake, and in response to all these so-called intellectuals and feminists talking about how Mormons are sexist, I just wanted to set the record straight. Mormonism is not sexist. Let me explain. The thing is, gender is a super important part of our eternal identity. In fact, we even had a gender back in the pre-mortal existence when everyone lived with God before they came to Earth. So all of us were either boys or girls even before we were born into male or female bodies, and whatever body you're born into is the gender you were before you were born, and the gender you'll be for the rest of eternity. I mean, sure, I guess there are some people that claim to identify themselves as a woman in a man's body or a man in a woman's body, but we're not even sure if that's a real thing anyway. And if it is, I'm sure God will figure something out. The reason that we know that gender is so important is because of modern-day prophets in the church that made a statement called the Family, a Proclamation to the World. This proclamation talks about how important the family unit is for society and how it needs to be made up of one man and one woman married to each other, and how if anything happens to mess with that definition of a family, then bad stuff is going to happen. And that was way back in 1995. Nobody was talking about family values way back then. They were way ahead of their time. That's how you can know that the people who wrote it were real prophets inspired by God. Anyway, one of the things the Family Proclamation talks about is the roles men and women have in a family, because the roles are different. Different, but equal. The man's role is to, you know, be the protector and breadwinner and preside over the family, and the woman's role is to nurture the children. So the father presides while the woman nurtures, but they do it as equal partners. Different, but equal. Think about it this way. The man is like the head of the household, but the woman is like the neck. So even though the head is technically running the rest of the body, the neck is just as important. I mean, you die without a neck, or at least look really weird. Plus, the neck can turn the head any way it wants. Even though technically the head would be the one telling the neck to move in the first place. Well, it's not a perfect metaphor, but you get the idea. The head and the neck work together as equals to help run the arms and legs and the rest of the family. Another big part of our gender identity has to do with the priesthood. Remember that the priesthood is the authority of God that lets people do legit baptisms and stuff. It's also the structure that makes up the administration of the church, like the prophet and apostles and people we call 70s and stake presidents and bishops and all that. Anyway, it turns out that only dudes can hold the priesthood, so only guys can be prophets or apostles or bishops. Don't get me wrong, anyone can get the blessings of the priesthood, like a legit baptism or a temple
marriage. It's just that the people that hold the priesthood and actually do things like baptize or marry people or give priesthood blessings or watch over a congregation or run administrative meetings or make decisions about church policy and curriculum are all guys. Now, at this point, you might be saying, but systematically prohibiting certain people from participating in the administrative body that determines church policy based solely on their gender is the textbook definition of sexism. But you couldn't be more wrong. The priesthood isn't something that exists to control people. It's there to give people the blessings of the gospel. Besides, us guys need something structured like priesthood responsibility to make us get off our behinds and help people in need. But just like we learned in the Family Proclamation, women don't need that kind of thing because they're naturally more nurturing. It's like this. Men have the priesthood, but women have motherhood. Different but equal roles. Well, maybe they're not exactly parallel. I mean, sure, technically the priesthood is available to all men in the church over the age of 12, regardless of physical limitations or marital status, while motherhood can technically stay out of a woman's reach through things beyond her control, like infertility or the inability to find a husband. And sure, technically a man doesn't need a woman involved at any point to wield the power of God, while a woman would need to bind herself with a man in a temple marriage performed by a man to be eligible for motherhood. And sure, a man receives the priesthood just by having other men with a priesthood set their hands on his head and say a prayer, while a woman becomes a mother by carrying another human inside of her for 9 months and then descending into the valley of the shadow of death. But you know, don't worry about it. You'll be doing cool God stuff before you know it. And for those still not convinced by these arguments, you're missing the point. The priesthood isn't about controlling people. It's about helping people. It's a freaking lay clergy, for crying out loud. You think guys like having to run a congregation in their spare time? What is it you feminists want? The authority? Why are you so obsessed with power anyway? Also, you have to remember that God's the one who put the whole system in place. He called the prophet and apostles, and they communicate directly with him. And God is gender neutral. I mean, he has a gender, he's obviously a dude, but he's not sexist, so he's never going to let those priesthood leaders do or say anything sexist. So it wouldn't make a difference if any of them were women anyway, since they're just doing what God wants, and God is definitely not a sexist. And if you still think Mormons are sexist, chew on this. The largest women's association in the world is the Mormon Relief Society, which women run all on their own and completely independently under priesthood supervision. We even let women wear pants to church. And after only 183 years, we just allowed a woman to give a prayer in our biennial general conference. Would a sexist organization do that? No way! The point is, Mormons don't see women as being less than men. Men and women just have different roles. Different but equal. See? Not sexist.
All right, thanks. What was that? Mormons... Okay, so that I am totally down with that. My question is, are we going to do Mormons don't hate gay people or Mormons really don't hate gay people, I swear? Both? All right, we're going to do them chronologically. All right, we'll do those two, and then it'll be the new... I don't know, I feel like I want to do the... policy-related one. Okay, I'm going to do that one. It's my presentation.
Hi, I'm Brother Jake. So, remember how I made a video about how Mormons don't hate gay people at all? Well, it turns out that people still think that Mormons think that gay people are bad or evil, but I promise, Mormons don't hate gay people. I swear. Now, the reason a lot of people might think that is because of some news articles that came out recently about how the church changed its policies about gay people and their kids in the Official Handbook of Instructions, which is like an owner's manual for the priesthood leaders, like stake presidents or bishops or whatever. The first change was a modification of the list of things that count as apostasy. Which, like I've talked about in an earlier video, is one of the things for which you can be excommunicated. So, in addition to the stuff that I was talking about before, being in a same-gender marriage is now considered one of the criteria for defining apostasy. But it's not like we're going after gay people, like it says here.
A church spokesman issued a statement on these changes, saying, quote, "The church has long been on record as opposing same-sex marriages. While it respects the law of the land and acknowledges the right of others to think and act differently, it does not perform or accept same-sex marriage within its membership."
Exactly. We've always opposed same-sex marriage. So this is just clarifying our stance on marriage and families. And, I mean, sure, technically homosexuality was already included as a serious transgression for which someone could receive formal church discipline, so adding it again here might seem like, I don't know, overkill? And yeah, that might seem a little strange when you look at the other things on the list, since they tend to focus on a central theme of protecting and maintaining the central beliefs of Mormonism, like that Mormonism is the one true church of God, and it's the only church with saving priesthood power and prophetic leadership. So I can see how by adding being in a same-gender marriage to the definition of apostasy... You might think that the church is signaling that being not gay is now one of the core tenets of the religion instead of just an incidental result of its doctrines on families and sexual purity, but like I said before, we're just clarifying our stance. Sometimes you gotta do that. I mean, seriously, when's the last time we let people know how we feel about gay marriage? Anyway, the other change in policy is this.
The policy states that a natural or adopted child of a parent living in a same-gender relationship, whether the couple is married or cohabiting, may not receive a name and a blessing. But the church goes further, saying children who live in a same-sex household may not be baptized. Only once a child is 18, no longer lives in that household, and specifically disavows the practice of same-gender cohabitation and marriage, could that happen. But the church's governing first presidency would have to approve it.
I can see how at this point some of you might be saying, but having a policy that prohibits children with a gay parent from being blessed or receiving ordinances until they're 18 will needlessly ostracize an already vulnerable population from their peers in the primary and youth programs. But that's crazy. I mean, it's not about ostracizing people. Just listen to this church apostle explain it.
This policy originates out of that compassion. It originates from a desire to protect children in their innocence and in their minority years. We don't want a child to have to deal with issues that might arise where the parents feel one way and the expectations of the church are very different.
Exactly. This policy is out of compassion. It's about love, really. And trust me, this guy knows what's up. He's got a gay brother. See, the policy protects these kids from situations where they learn things at church that conflict with what they learn at home. It doesn't protect them from learning them, per se, because they're still welcome to come to church and learn the things that we teach. They just can't, you know, be members or whatever. And yes, prohibiting the children of gay parents from being baptized under the pretense of protecting them from conflict between their home life and the teachings of the church might seem like a punitive double standard, since we allow the blessing and baptism and ordination of kids whose parents violate the tenets of Mormonism by drinking or smoking or doing drugs or living together without being married all the time without any issue whatsoever. And sure, the addition of this policy might seem to imply that homosexuality is some sort of ultra super mega sin, but it's not like those kids can never get those ordinances. Well, except for the baby blessing thing. That's pretty much off the table. But you don't need that one to be saved anyway, so whatever. And things like baptism are fine after they turn 18, right?
There's time for that if when a child reaches majority, he or she feels like that's what they want. And they can make an informed and conscious decision about that. Nothing is lost to them in the end if that's the direction they want to go. And in the meantime, they're not placed in a position where there will be difficulties, challenges, conflicts that can injure their development in very tender years.
Right. They're not barred forever. They can do all that stuff if they're up for it when they're adults. And in the meantime, we're protecting them in their tender early years by prohibiting them from joining God's one true church on earth and receiving the super awesome gift of the Holy Ghost like all the other kids, so that we don't interfere with their upbringing in a counterfeit family whose union is an abomination in the sight of God. Isn't that loving? We're actually helping them. We're trying to make sure these family relationships stay strong. I mean, up to a certain point, if the kids of gay parents want to get baptized at 18, they do have to move out of the gay parents' house and then specifically disavow their gay parents' gay lifestyle, which might put a bit of strain on the relationship, but we didn't make the rule that homosexuality was an ultra super mega sin. God did, so what are you going to do? And yeah, the disavowal thing kind of flies in the face of statements like this.
So would supporting gay marriage threaten somebody's membership in the church if they went out, say, on Facebook or Twitter and actively advocated for it?
Yeah, that's not an organized, you know, effort to attack our effort or attack our functioning as a church, if you will.
So members can hold those beliefs even though they're different from what you teach at the pulpit?
Yes.
Since it's hard to imagine how it's possible for an institution to simultaneously allow members to privately support the idea of gay marriage in general while requiring people to specifically disavow it in order to become members. But, you know, disavowing stuff isn't that big a deal. People do it all the time. But we're getting lost in the weeds here. Those situations are mostly hypothetical anyway. Think about it. These are kids being raised by gay parents. They're not going to want their kids to be part of the church anyway, so it's all a technicality. Oh, unless the biological parents were in one of those mixed orientation marriages that are all too common in conservative religious communities like Mormonism, and then the parents divorced amicably and share custody between the gay parent and the non-gay parent, but the policy probably excludes cases like that, right? Let's see. A natural or adopted child of a parent living in a same-gender... Oh, okay. That. Wait, here. A natural or adopted child of a parent living in a same... gender relationship. Okay, no, hold on. Mission president, recommend missionary service for a child of a parent who has lived or is living in the same gender relationship. That's kind of broad. Shoot.
The situation with polygamous families, for example, and same-sex marriage couples and families really has a parallel. For generations, we've had these same kinds of policies that relate to children in polygamous families.
Right. The polygamy thing. This isn't new. We've already been doing this with kids from polygamous homes, and you didn't care. Where was all your outrage then? I mean, sure, responding to criticism for doing a supposedly bad thing by saying that we've already been doing it for a long time isn't exactly an airtight defense. And yes, the fact that we have had and will continue to have policies that place ostracizing restrictions on children because of their parents' behavior seems to violate our own second article of faith and that whole suffer the little ones thing that Jesus said. But you have to remember who's making the decisions here. God is leading the church through his prophets, and even though we haven't really heard anything from the current prophet about this particular policy, you gotta have faith that God won't let them lead the church astray. So even if this policy seems to go against your own moral compass and violate the church's own doctrine and cause harm to non-hypothetical real people in the real world right now in the present, you just need to be patient and rest assured that it's probably the right thing to do. Even if it really seems like, you know, it isn't. So you see, it's all about love.
All right. I mean, it looks like there's pretty much full here. Okay, so I have a question for the audience. Do we have any fans of Hamilton in the audience? Okay, well, I think you're going to like this. I think you will like it. All right. Okay, oh, hold on. Sorry. Dang it. I botched it. I bumbled it. Open with...
How does a poor boy charmer, son of a drunk and a farmer, living in the middle of a forgotten spot of rocky soil up in Vermont, just scraping by on smidgens, grow up to start a bona fide religion? The young all-American prophet with no profit grew up struggling for survival during a religious revival where dueling preachers would all rival each other through their reprisals. But by the age of 20, Joseph found himself on trial. You see, he had indulged in something they called treasure seeking, where he put a rock in a hat and tell people he was peeking hidden goodies, which he'd help you snatch up for a small fee, but he never seemed to find the things he said that he could see. Now all that was in the past when he asked for Emma's hand, at least that's what he told her father when they spoke man to man. But in the end he'd used the very same rock in the same way to produce the Book of Mormon that we know and love today. Well, the word got around, they said this Mormon book is nice, man. They say that it's another testament of Jesus Christ, man. People started flocking in as Mormonism grew, and locals started asking, who's the leader of this crew, man? Our prophet's name is Joseph Smith, but you can call him Brother Joseph. And there's a million things he hasn't done, but just you wait, just you wait. All the people buying into this newly minted religion tried to settle down and live out their new conviction, but were viewed with superstition. They were met with opposition. From Ohio to Missouri, folks would call for their eviction. So Joseph and his crew went and settled in Nauvoo, where they turned the marshy lands into a shining jewel of industrious society that converts could flock to make a life and follow what their new prophet taught to. Well, it started working out with Brother Joseph at the head. Man built a temple for endowments and baptisms for the dead. And he kept dropping knowledge like Section 132, a brand new commandment for God's chosen man, for the ladies to restore the ancient order. Ladies, got Abraham up in his corner. Ladies, he started teaching polygamy, but I guess this revelation must have called for some secrecy, cause most of these weddings were going down on the sly, bro. And when accused, he'd give carefully worded denial. denials. His inner circle's trust had started to evaporate as they questioned his creation of a theocratic state. By the summer of 1844, dissent was at a roar. His former homies' exposés in the Nauvoo Expositor. To stop the damning information, he called for incineration of the press, which led to his arrest and subsequent incarceration. And while he sat in Carthage jail, a mob attacked the building. He met them guns a-blazin', but they still broke through and killed him. As he busted through the window and fell to his death, a Masonic cry for help would form the prophet's final breath. Oh Lord, my God, is there no help for the widow's son? What was his name, man? Our prophet's name was Joseph Smith.
Well, I haven't uploaded it online, so it's going to go up later today. You are the first people to see it. I kind of want to ask, do you want to see it again? Well, okay, I'll do it again at the end, right, before we wrap up. Yeah, that really went over. I'm glad that went well. Great. Woo! I was nervous. Okay. I've actually been singing, singing this for the past, 3 weeks after I wrote it, so. I'll also have the MP3 on SoundCloud if you want to, download it. I don't know if the audio quality's more or less. But I feel like everything is going to be a letdown after that. I was thinking we could watch some of the older ones, and then toward the end we'll watch this one again. Sound good? Do you want to watch the other Mormons Don't Hate Gay People?
Yeah.
All right. Let's go to that one. Oh, Correlation. Another musical one? Oh, shoot. Correlation I don't have on this thing. I'm sorry. I couldn't. I do have True Believing Mormon, dude, if anybody's interested in that one. What? Yeah, listen, that was a good one. That one's a good one. All right, let's try this one.
I am the very model of a true believing Mormon dude. I have a friendly disposition and a cheerful attitude. I don't use coffee, tea, tobacco, booze, or drugs, or say bad words. I don't mind giving 10% of my gross income to the church. And I believe that Joseph Smith saw God and Jesus in the woods, and they told him that not one church was following them like they should, and later he translated the gold book he found in his backyard. And that became the Book of Mormon, which has spread both near and far, and that's how the true church and living prophets were restored on earth. So we know coffee is bad, and we had a gender before birth. I have a friendly disposition and a cheerful attitude. I am the very model of a true believing Mormon dude. I served a 2-year mission after freshman year at BYU to teach people America was colonized by ancient Jews. When I came home, I married at the ripe old age of 22, just like my siblings Hiram, Brittany, Colby, Lauren, Jason, Katie, Blake, and Drew. The law of chastity is something that I think is pretty great. That's how we know that it's a sin to make out and to masturbate. But despite the rumors, we don't think it's bad if you are gay. It's just wrong if you act on it in anything you do or say. And I feel weird when people talk about my Mormon underwear. And when I go to church, I dress real nice and shave my facial hair. And even though you might be thinking this guy is a giant prude, it's no big deal because I am a true believing Mormon dude. So you see that Mormonism really isn't weird at all. It's just a nice pro-family church that built some temples and a mall. Well, sure, there was that one time when we kinda did polygamy, and then there was some racist stuff and maybe some misogyny. But that was just a phase. We really don't do that stuff anymore. Well, maybe just a little, but don't worry, I'll explain it more. So come to our 3-hour weekly service to see what we do.
And you can learn about all the cool stuff that God has planned for you. And later in the temple, you can marry for eternity. So even after death, you can still have a happy family. These are the things I know are true, and through prayer, you can know them too. And you can be the model of a true believing Mormon dude. Hi, I'm Brother Jake. Now, there are a lot of people out there who say that Mormons don't like people that are suffering from same-sex attraction, but that's not true at all. Let me explain. I mean, sure, there have been a few times when prophets and apostles had said stuff that might not seem super positive about those type of people, like this.
Homosexuality is an ugly sin. The ancient cities of Sodom and Gomorrah are symbols of wretched wickedness, more especially related to their perversion.
Or this.
Some suppose that they were preset and cannot overcome what they feel are inborn tendencies toward the impure and the unnatural. Not so. Why would our Heavenly Father do that to anyone?
But the reality is that we totally love people who are same-sex attracted, and I bet having to deal with all that being same-sex attracted and whatnot, it's super hard. But there's this thing called the law of chastity, which I've talked about before, and that's where God commanded that doing stuff like having, you know, sex with somebody you're not married to is almost as bad as murdering somebody, and that applies to everyone. So it's not like we're singling same-sex attracted people out or anything, we're just saying that they have to live the law of chastity just like everyone else. So that's it. Problem solved. Well, kind of. I mean, I guess you could say that there's some difference in how the law of chastity works for people who are gay because of one teeny tiny thing, which is that while there's some opportunity for normal people to experience the dozens of avenues of romantic and emotional validation that can be pursued before marriage, like flirting or going on dates or hugging or kissing or holding hands or cuddling, as well as a fully sexual relationship with someone to whom they're attracted after marriage, there's really no acceptable way for gay people to act on their sex drive ever in any way at all, because while we totally don't hate gay people, like I said, we're really not into people, you know, acting gay. But that's just because we're super big fans of traditional marriage, and we think that's the only type of marriage that should be legally allowed. Now, at this point, you might be wondering what exactly it is that makes a marriage traditional. Like, is it the tradition to marry for love rather than the earlier non-traditional tradition of marrying for economic or political reasons? Or is it the tradition of committing to sexual fidelity with your spouse? Or is it the tradition of promising to support each other in sickness and health and care for any dependents that might come along? Well, no. I mean, those are all good things, don't get me wrong, but the thing that really makes a marriage traditional comes down to the genders of the people in it. See, a traditional marriage needs a man and a woman, and we know that because in the biblical account of the creation, it only mentions a man and a woman, and obviously anything not specifically mentioned in that story must be stuff that God doesn't like. After all, it's Adam and Eve, not Adam and his really good friend Patrick, who always wears cardigans and for some reason is in all of Adam's Christmas cards. And sure, it might seem a bit shaky to adhere to such strict literalism for that particular passage, since that part of the Bible also includes a talking snake, a fruit that could grant you knowledge just by eating it, and a magical garden where nothing ever died. Oh, plus, if we are going by the every type of marriage not mentioned in the Adam and Eve story is out of bounds idea, that puts Mormons in a bit of an awkward position since we used to practice, and technically still do in our temples, which I talked about in another video, a form of marriage that includes one man and multiple women, but that's just for special occasions when God really needs it, like with Abraham or Joseph Smith or Brigham Young. The bottom line is that although there are people who are saying that it's okay for a marriage to have two men or like two women with no man at all, I guess, in order to be traditional, a marriage needs at least one, but you know, sometimes more women, and one and only one man. Now, at this point, you might be thinking, but reducing the definition of traditional marriage to an issue of gender rather than focusing on arguably more important elements of the institution, like the long-term commitment of fidelity and love, is incredibly simplistic and short-sighted, but we're not making the rules God is. And although the perception of the institution of marriage has shifted significantly over history from being primarily an arranged union used to transfer property or political power to the modern notion of a mutual declaration of love and commitment, we're 100% positive that having the correct number of men and women is definitely the one thing that makes traditional marriage, well, traditional. And yes, even if we do accept that totally airtight premise for establishing what a traditional marriage is, it may still kind of seem like a violation of the separation of church and state to use religious conviction as a basis for maintaining laws that restrict the type of unions the state recognizes, but like I said in an earlier video, this is a Christian nation, so it's totally cool to enact public policy based on Christian theology.
The thing you need to understand here is that traditional marriage is like super important for society. And just like it says in our Proclamation on the Family, any changes to traditional marriage will have huge negative consequences, especially for children. See, the most obvious problem with letting people of the same gender get married is because they can't have kids, since you need a man and a woman to make a child. And that's not me being mean or anything, that's just science. I mean, yeah, reducing the purpose of marriage strictly down to biological reproduction might seem a tad inconsistent, since by that same logic, we should probably stop granting heterosexual marriages to couples who are elderly or infertile, but it goes beyond just having kids, it's about raising them, too.
Unmarried mothers have massive challenges, and the evidence is clear that their children are at a significant disadvantage when compared with children raised by married parents. We should assume the same disadvantages for children raised by couples of the same gender.
Exactly. Children born to single parents have big disadvantages, and extrapolating that those disadvantages will apply to children raised by two parents of the same gender is totally logical, since the difficulties of being a single parent don't stem from the overwhelming correlation between single parenthood and poverty or low education or lack of resources. It's all because a single parent household only has one gender in it. And since, like I talked about before, men and women have divinely mandated separate but equal family roles that just so happen to align with 20th century gender ideals, and since the value of each parent's contribution to the complex and arduous process of child rearing can be primarily accounted for by the anatomy they were born with, obviously children in a home with parents with the same parts will be lacking the advantages and completeness that they would have had if their parents had different parts. Anyway, the other big problem with same-sex marriage is that if it becomes legal, it'll kind of make it so that not as many people get normal married. And I definitely have well-reasoned points for saying that. I mean, sure, it might seem a tiny bit strange for me to argue that allowing consenting adults of the same gender to enter a state-sponsored legal agreement that was historically only available to adults of the opposite gender is going to somehow ruin that agreement for the non-gay people, since the people getting gay married are, I've been told, actually gay, so it's not like they'd be getting married to people of the opposite gender anyway, But hear me out. If gay marriage is legal, maybe more people will become gay, so then some people who would have gotten normal married won't. And yeah, saying that kind of flies in the face of a large and ongoing body of research that indicates that pretty much everyone who self-identifies as gay doesn't really choose to be attracted to people of the same gender in the same way that pretty much all the non-gay people don't choose to be attracted to people of the opposite gender. But think about it. There are way more gay people out there than there were like 100 years ago. I mean, sure, that might just be due to a societal trend toward removing the stigma against homosexuality over the past century that has allowed gay people to feel more comfortable about admitting that they're gay instead of just hiding it, getting normal married, and then living out nice, quiet, sexually dysfunctional lives. So it might not be that people are being, like, converted to gayism or whatever so much as that a larger percentage of people who are already gay are just being more open about it. But it's like this. Imagine you have a pie, like a beautiful, perfect, traditional pie. But then this kid named Kevin comes up and he's like, I have a pie too. But it's like it has like ice cream in it and the crust is made out of cookies or something. It's just not the same. The thing is that Kevin having that thing and calling it a pie just makes the pie you're eating not as good, because pie is pie. And if it's not pie, then it's something else. And what he has isn't pie, man. It's just not. And if that's a pie, who's to say that this isn't a pie? Or this? Or this? And pretty soon, everyone's just walking around with whatever they want, calling it pie, until it's like the word pie doesn't mean anything anymore, so what's the point of having any pie at all? And then the pie is ruined for everybody, and it's just wrong, and it's unnatural, and it's gross! I mean, it's not gross. We really don't hate gay people at all, I swear. We even have a website about how much we don't hate gays. So, there you go. It's not natural. I mean, yeah, homosexual interaction is actually surprisingly common in the animal kingdom, but it's like this.
People inquire about our position on those who consider themselves so-called gays and lesbians. My response is that we love them as sons and daughters of God. They may have certain inclinations which are powerful and which may be difficult to control. Most people have inclinations of one kind or another at various times.
Exactly. We love gay people, but we were put on this earth to be tested, and everyone's got their own temptations and difficulties that they have to work through. Say, for example, there was a guy who was like a super kleptomaniac, just like overcome with a desire to steal stuff. But since stealing is wrong, he has to resist that temptation for his whole life. But if he does, after he dies, he'll be cured of wanting to do all the bad stuff, and he'll get to go to super VIP heaven and do cool God stuff. It's the same thing with gay people. Sure, being born in a gay body is super hard, no question about it. And we're not saying that you can be changed through reparative therapy or anything. Well, Well, not anymore, anyway. We're just saying that if gay people just hang on and keep the law of chastity in this life, they'll be able to get resurrected in a not-gay body and get married to, I don't know, some lady who never got married and is just, like, hanging out, I guess? Unless the gay person was a lady, then she'd probably get, like, married to some super righteous dude as one of his wives. But anyway, God will figure it all out. The point is that if they just keep the commandments, they can get into super VIP heaven just like anybody. Now, at this point, you might be saying, but equating something as fundamental to somebody's personality as sexual identity and the desire for intimacy and connection with a disorder with such obvious social harms and selfish motivation as kleptomania trivializes the sacrifice of complete and utter lifelong celibacy that gay Mormons are being asked to make, but it's super VIP heaven. Think about it. It's like, what, 70, 80 years of constantly repressing the desire for romance and companionship and family for, like, a bazillion years of doing cool God stuff with somebody you got paired up with from among the righteous loners left over after death. It's totally worth it. Eternal perspective, man. So you see, we don't hate gay people. We just love families.
Thank you. I wanted to open up for some Q&A stuff. If anyone has any questions, yes. Oh yeah, that's a good question. So the creative process is mostly just procrastination. Followed by, I set up some sort of arbitrary, in this case it was not an arbitrary deadline, I had an actual deadline, and I finished it last night. No, this morning, so, hey. But usually I put some sort of deadline, I gotta get this out this month, this just gotta happen. And then it's just procrastination, and then just frantic, manic effort until the end. Well, usually it starts with the writing portion of it. So first, she may be embarrassed by this, but I want to recognize my wife, Erica Schertz, who is she's the ultimate. She's my final filter for anything that goes out. It has to get the Erica thumb, you know, the Erica stamp of approval. So I'll write. I'll come up with a topic and then, you know, research it and write it, and that takes a couple weeks just because. I'll write it and get frustrated and be like, forget this, I'm done. Brother Jake's dead. And then I'll be like, well, I can give it another shot. I'll try it again. And she helps me out with all the wording. Erica gives me kind of the final look through, says, change this wording, try this, move this here. And then at that point is the recording and the animation. So the recording is like... it's not one take. I hope that's obvious. It's many takes. I probably do one, two sentences at a time that I can get right, and then I just cut out all the spaces between them. The animation phase of it is just as you're going through it, kind of play with the timing. But you know, the program that I use is really quite simple. As long as I can, I have some Photoshop, so I doll up some of the images, and that's it. So I'd say like start to finish, it's about a month or 3 weeks or something for just writing it and then doing all the recording and animation. It's this online program called Powtoon. In some of the earlier videos, you can see a watermark on the bottom right corner of the screen. It's an online thing where you can upload like a track, and then they have some. You can upload your own images, or they have different objects on there where you can do like just like it zooms in from the right at this second, and then it zooms out at that second, and very simple type of stuff. Yes.
Did you ever worry you'd be targeted or censured by the church, or was that ever an issue for you?
I never really thought about it, and it's never happened. I've never been approached by anybody in an official capacity from the church at all. So I don't know. Pretty much under the radar. Never had an issue with that. I think I saw something over here. You're learning. You're picking up quick. I think we have another. We got another one. You can pick up the mantle when I'm finished. I thought I saw something over here, right? So my background in the church is I grew up in rural Arizona. I'm the youngest of eight children, and I
went on a mission to, I went to BYU, I didn't graduate from there, but I went to BYU, I went on a mission to Peru, and then when I got back, about a year after I got back from my mission, I married my wife, and we moved to Indiana, where she did a master's program there, and I finished my undergrad, and it was somewhere around there. It was one day when she was in that ward, she had had a Sunday school lesson where somebody had kind of batted down some of her, the nuance that she was trying to inject into the lesson with the gospel simple. And at that point, I had been watching, I don't know if anyone has ever heard of John Green, the author. He wrote The Fault in Our Stars, but he has this online web series called Crash Course World History. It's really similar. I mean, it totally cribbed the whole visual style from it. So it's like really fast-paced and fast-paced with little fun little graphics type things. And we'd been watching a lot of that recently, and we said, okay, so what if we just put all of it together, you know, put the whole gospel down, just laid it out and explain, you know, how someone might not see it as simple. So anyway, at that point, I mean, I'm still on the records of the church. I haven't attended for a couple years, but my family's still active and things. I think I saw something over here, and then I'll go over there. This is my cousin, by the way. So it's not not just some guy like, I know this.
Right.
You saw
this short. Right.
How entrenched
you were to begin with.
Well,
you lived in the mission field.
I was little. I was like two. I wasn't making memories back then. But the thing is, I want to make a delineation between being a young adult in the church and then raising children in the church, or, you know, serving as a bishop in the church, or serving as a Relief Society president, something like that, where like, or moving, you know, serving as part of a family ward for years where you know the people, you know, around you. It's, so that's why I think I'm kind of downplaying it, because there's a lot more exposure to Mormonism that you can have than what I had. But yeah, I mean, I grew up in a conservative family and I was very devout, so. Was there something over here? How has what affected me?
Just this process.
Well, it's been nice to have, I'm overwhelmed by the response that this has gotten. I never thought, because when I made the first one, I just kind of put it on YouTube. I've never done like an ads thing on YouTube. I just put them on YouTube and just kind of threw them out there. And I've been absolutely overwhelmed by the response. I mean, this room is full. It's full of people looking at me right now. It's really kind of unnerving. Frankly, but you know, it's pretty good. It was good for me to be able to express some of that angst, right? To use the same kind of terminology as what I was hearing, but then you know, when you hear the Happy Birthday song in a minor key, and it sounds like rather than being like Happy Birthday, a celebration of life, it's like now you're closer to death. Right, you're one year closer to the endless void of nothingness. You know, that's what it. So I wanted to get kind of that subtle change to communicate how something, the same words could sound differently in a different context. So in that case, it's been useful for me. I mean, it's been a helpful kind of therapeutic thing for me. Yes.
So when is the Spanish version coming out?
Oh, the Spanish version. See, I had some. I had somebody approach me about submitting, on YouTube you can upload little files that will that'll subtitle it for you, do closed captioning in Spanish. So I've been slacking on that, but I'll get back in touch with them and just, you know, soon. I would say, yeah, go ahead.
I just want you to know that your videos have helped get through some pretty tough times.
Oh, good. Oh, actually, my family has kind of stumbled across them incidentally, just kind of, which has been, I don't know, whatever. I avoid conflict in general in life, so I don't, I don't show them at family reunions. When they were uncovered in my family, it was kind of a shock, and there was a little tension there, but after that, it's been fine. I mean, all my immediate family members are devout members of the church and things, so I don't want to offend them too much. But Lindsay, sorry, is that okay? So it isn't until 5 minutes. Okay, then I'll take one more, and then we'll watch the Hamilton one again, and then we'll be done. It'll be 5 minutes. We'll be done. Yeah. Okay. Good. So. Finding the topics is just whatever I kind of think. I mean, I get a lot of suggestions from people online. People go on the website and can submit comments. I enjoy that. Whatever one sounds like it has legs, I'll go for. But if it just feels like it's interesting to me, then I go for that one. I don't really have a specific formula. But professionally, I'm a statistician for a healthcare company. So very unrelated to this. This is just a hobby. I'll be later at the Infants on Thrones table, which is next to the East Ballroom, later throughout the afternoon if you want to stop by and say hello. I just want to do this. Yes, and we'll have Glenn Oslin there is modeling the T-shirts for Infants on Thrones that are on there. All right. Looking good? Looking good. Okay. This is the final thing, and then we'll be done as soon as this is this video plays. It's only 2 minutes long. All right.
How does a poor boy, charmer, son of a drunk and a farmer, living in the middle of a forgotten spot of rocky soil up in Vermont, just scraping by on smidgens, grow up to start a bona fide religion? The young all-American prophet with no profit grew up struggling for survival during a religious revival where dueling preachers would all rival each other through their reprisals. But by the age of 20, Joseph found himself on trial. You see, he had indulged in something they called treasure seeking, where he put a rock in a hat and tell people he was peeking hidden goodies, which he'd help you snatch up for a small fee, but he never seemed to find the things he said that he could see. Now all that was in the past when he asked for Emma's hand, at least that's what he told her father when they spoke man to man. But in the end he'd used the very same rock in the same way to produce the Book of Mormon that we know and love today. Well, the word got around, they said this Mormon book is nice, man. They say that it's another testament of Jesus Christ, man. People started flocking in as Mormonism grew, and locals started asking, who's the leader of this crew, man? Our prophet's name is Joseph Smith, but you can call him Brother Joseph. And there's a million things he hasn't done, but just you wait, just you wait. All the people buying into this newly minted religion tried to settle down and live out their new conviction, but were viewed with superstition. They were met with opposition. From Ohio to Missouri, folks would call for their eviction. So Joseph and his crew went and settled in Nauvoo, where they turned the marshy lands into a shining jewel of industrious society that converts could flock to make a life and follow what their new prophet taught to. Well, it started working out with Brother Joseph at the head. Man built a temple for endowments and baptisms for the dead. And he kept dropping knowledge like section 132, a brand new commandment for God's chosen man, for the ladies, to restore the ancient order.
Ladies,
got Abraham up in his corner.
Ladies,
he started teaching polygamy, but I guess this revelation must have called for some secrecy, 'cause most of these weddings were going down on the sly, bro. And when accused, he'd give carefully worded denials. His inner circle's trust had started to evaporate as they questioned his creation of a theocratic state.
By the summer of 1844, dissent was at a roar. His former homies exposés in the Nauvoo Expositor, to stop the damning information, he called for incineration of the press, which led to his arrest and subsequent incarceration.
And while he sat in Carthage jail, a mob attacked the building. He met them guns a-blazing, but they still broke through and killed him as he busted through the window and fell to his death. A Masonic cry for help would form the prophet's final breath.
Oh Lord, my God.
Our prophet's name was Joseph Smith.